Hey, hockey fans. Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
What happened to 22-year-old Lisa Dodd, who had just moved to this place in Alton, is beyond irreprehensible. It's abominable.
She wasn't kidding.
I have a case for you today that is one that I would normally reserve for my exclusive and Patreon episodes because it's, well, it's beyond horrific and beyond the usual horrificness and of course, the average true crime listener. But I'm going to try and tone it down a little bit just to, so that I can tell the story to the largest audience that I can, because it's a tale that I think really needs to be told, and Lisa Dodd deserves a voice in getting her story out there. And it's kind of a cautionary tale, and I think that there's some lessons in here that could be useful. But we're going to travel through here with no judgment, because what's done is done, and we don't need to do victim blaming and any of that kind of nonsense. Hence why I say it's a cautionary tale and not an I told you so tale. Lisa Dodd was 22 years old. She was living in Alton, Illinois, and she was in her final trimester of her very first pregnancy, anticipating the birth of a daughter. Now, according to some media accounts, she and her mother, Heidi, had been preparing for the arrival of the baby, buying some baby clothes, making nursery plans, and the dreams of just what motherhood would look like for Lisa. Sometime in 2020 or thereabouts, she met and started dating a man named DeAndrea Holloway. And this relationship was what a lot of people considered kind of on again, off again. And their relationship continued that way, mostly on, for about 2 years. They had some periods of closeness and then some distance, stability, and then not so much stability. Now, it is not believed that Holloway was the father of her unborn child, although they both said that he was. Now, I'm not sure if this later speculation is a result of something that DeAndrea said, or if it was DNA results that were discovered later. So as far as I know, that is only speculation that he was not the father. By June of 2022, Lisa was nearly due for the baby to be born. She was approximately 8 months pregnant, and she knew she was going to be having a daughter. DeAndrea was known by her coworkers and her boss, as well as her neighbors, to be at times physically abusive. But no one at that time had been able to get her.
We were just excited and kind of gathering the items you need to have a baby. A beautiful soul. And I just wish she would have known how loved she was. You know, that she wouldn't have ever been alone. She could have gotten out of this relationship and had a full life.
Lisa was in an on-again, off-again relationship with a man named Dion.
Yet beneath that hope, there were some warning signs. Lisa's mother later revealed that she had become pretty concerned when she wasn't able to get a hold of her daughter. She had known of the tensions that were in Lisa's relationship with DeAndrea, which we are going to come around to that part here in a little bit. Now, her relationship with DeAndrea was known by her coworkers and her boss, as well as her neighbors, to be at times physically abusive. But no one at that time had been able to get her to leave the relationship for good. She remained bonded to DeAndrea, and any attempts to kind of get her to see the danger that maybe she was in was, they kind of fell on a little bit of deaf ears, which does not make Lisa delusional or silly or unintelligent by any means. Anyone who has ever loved someone and then found that someone in a situation that they know is bad for them knows that there's this trauma bonding that happens and that leaving is not actually a very simple answer. She loved him, and like many that suffer from abuse, she felt that the physical assaults that she were getting were kind of her own fault for not being like a better person. It's that self-esteem that just sort of tumbles when you hear over and over again your failings from someone that makes you believe that they're true. You become kind of defensive of the person that's abusing you. So, you know, you think to yourself, no, it's not my, it's my fault. I shoulda, coulda, woulda. So don't ever judge someone for staying in a relationship that you know is toxic. I mean, don't stop trying to help them and trying to get them out of that relationship, but try not to get too frustrated by their constant returns to the arms of their abuser. Here is Lisa's boss from the Dairy Queen where she was working at the time.
I think she was making up a story. Okay. And then she finally did tell me that she had had some problems with her boyfriend, was hitting her, and they were actually homeless and were living out at the campground at the lake. She had a lot of personal problems with a boyfriend, a lot of calling off. She had a lot of black eyes when she would come in. When she first started, she would make excuses that her dog had jumped up and hit her and caused her black eyes. She was constantly running late, like for personal reasons, always something coming up. She had a lot of black eyes, a lot of bruising on her arms, like where you could see, you know, like maybe grabbing.
Okay.
That kind of thing. Eventually, after the, you know, excuses about, you know, the dog and things like that stopped, she was honest about it and just said that they were always arguing and fighting and, you know, then they would make up and it would happen again.
So the night of June 8th and into the 9th of 2022 is when the horror of Lisa's story unfolds. And the details of that night are kind of pieced together from investigative reports, press releases, and some court filings. Some of them remain a little bit incomplete. What she encountered was beyond any parent's darkest nightmare. Inside the apartment, she found Lisa's body. It had been decapitated. What she encountered was beyond any parent's darkest nightmare. Inside the apartment, she found Lisa's body. It had been decapitated, as in the head had been removed. I just simply cannot fathom what that horror was like to stumble across for Heidi. My heart goes out to her for the after effects that she must suffer on a daily basis since that discovery.
I got a message from her last night.
What time did you last hear from her?
It was like 9:05 or so. I had sent her a text and she said they were talking. And then I tried again at 10 and she didn't answer. And then I tried this morning two times and she didn't answer. And so then I came over here because she usually answers.
Okay. So last time you talked to her was last night when she sent your text message, right?
Yeah.
Okay. The officers are coming. They'll be there.
She'll
be okay. Okay. Okay.
The scene was completely unthinkable. Investigators described her remains as having been dismembered, which is a very deliberate act. It is not the result, of course, of any post-mortem decomposition or scavengers of animals around. This was deliberate. And the fact that the head was separated and then disposed of separately just sort of reiterated the crime's calculated nature. And it's a detail that is often repeated because of its sheer cruelty. Like a decapitation, it's done after the killing and indicates that the motive is not only to kill, but to degrade and also to conceal and also to shock the person that finds the body. And this disposal of her head in a dumpster away from the body, which was found later, really underscored how this act was intended in this case to obliterate like her body, but also her identity. And at that time, Lisa's unborn child died as well, meaning that two lives were lost that night.
To lose a child that way, and that baby is an extension of her mother and the rest of her family. So They lost a child as well. They lost two.
To make matters even more agonizing for her mother and her other loved ones, her daughter's vision of her motherhood was extinguished that night. So following the discovery of her body, law enforcement in Alton and Madison County launched a rather intensive investigation, as you can imagine. This crime was shocking, not only in its scale, but in that deliberate nature and the cruelty of it. Now, DeAndre quickly emerged as a suspect, of course. He was seen on the cameras that are around the apartment where they had lived together. He was leaving the apartment with this laundry basket about an hour after they had gone into the apartment together for the last time. However, things had actually started to unravel the day before when DeAndre suddenly left their apartment without his phone and kind of vanished on Lisa. So when Lisa had come home from work that afternoon, DeAndre wasn't there. And Lisa wondered if maybe he had ghosted her and left her to raise this baby on her own, which was something her mom thought would be a blessing in disguise because they were sort of texting back and forth about his sudden disappearance. But Lisa didn't see it that way. So she was worried enough about him that she actually called their landlord to pull the camera footage and see when it was that he had left, like under what circumstances. And he had left that afternoon with his Uncle Morty. But she still thought that that was odd, so she wanted some answers around that. So she started calling some of DeAndre's family, who hadn't heard from him either. But later that evening, his Uncle Morty called and said that she could go and pick him up, which she did. And then they returned to the apartment and they went in together. Now, Lisa never came out again. And after leaving the apartment with this cryptic laundry basket, which we all later learned contained Lisa's head.
So when they come out to the dumpster, there's a lot of clothes and shit in there all strewed all over. Laundry basket, and there was a couple pair of shoes. There was shoes, was some slipper shoes too. Slipper shoes.
Okay.
They was red. They had blood on them. They all look like female shit. For real though. Male shit too.
Female and male clothes?
Yeah. Okay.
He seemingly disappeared again. So the police talked with neighbors and some members of DeAndre's family, including his sister, his grandmother, and his mother, and they started to learn some rather disturbing details about the night before her body had been discovered.
2:30 in the morning that he's like banging on the door and stuff, and he's like pacing and like acting nervous.
Where?
At my house.
This morning?
This morning. Okay. At 2:30. I see my grandma standing in the doorway to the bathroom, and I looked, and I'm like, oh, there's Dee.
And what's his demeanor like?
He was, like, nervous. Like, you can tell he was, like, really nervous.
Just your personal opinion, why do you think he's cutting his hair off?
Got in trouble. Clothes that he had on, he took them outside for some reason, and he said it, by the sidewalk, and then he comes back in, and then he was...
Did you see him take those clothes off?
Yes.
So is that why he... Because you said he didn't have a shirt to wear. So when do you see him take the clothes off?
He had a hoodie on and some pants, and then he took his shirt off, or his hoodie off, when he was cutting his hair, I guess, because it was already off.
Mm-hmm.
And then he still had the pants on and stuff, and the hoodie was on the bathroom floor.
And then that's when he gets out and asks your mom for clothes?
Yeah.
And then he didn't have a shirt on, obviously.
Because he didn't want to put the same clothes back on.
He had I don't even know what his girlfriend's name is. Okay. But anyhow, he had gave me her ID and the debit card.
Okay.
And I said, well, why you got her debit card?
Yeah.
And license, you know. And I said, now she out there driving, and then she thinks she got her license, and you got it. Then this morning, he gave me two keys.
Okay.
And I said, well, where you get these keys from? And he said he found them on the ground.
I'm like, if you knew where he's at, would you tell me?
I would. Like, if I knew what was going on, I would tell you. But from last night of him doing the disappearing act to what's going on now. I have no clue, like, what transpired.
Are you afraid of him?
Yeah, I have an order of protection on him.
Okay, okay. Yeah. And what prompted you to get that?
He was staying with me for a couple days, and he was becoming frightening, like he was going to do something. So I was like, you got to go. And so when he left, he called my daughter back and was like, I love you guys, but I'm coming back to kill you.
Now, I just kind of have to warn you about this next clip. It's chilling to listen to, so you might want to skip forward about 2 minutes here.
Well, the past few days, they've been arguing, and that's nothing new. Last night, it was different. It was like, we got home from picking me up from work. I got home from work around 9:30-ish. Okay. And their front door was cracked, which is unusual. They don't...
9:30 p.m. last
yes.
night?
Okay. Muffled yelling, like not screaming, but yelling in a way, kind of like in pain. Like okay. he just like snipped your finger with a scissor and you had to put some over your mouth so you wouldn't scream too loud. That's what it sounded like.
So you say it sounded like muffled screaming?
Kind of, but it wasn't too loud because we were just going to go sit outside and wait it out.
Yeah.
So we didn't have to deal with it. And so whenever that was happening, the apartment was shaking, they were fighting about something, and then all of a sudden the screaming got really, really loud and really intense. And then the apartment had like 5 or 6 loud like thuds, and they got louder and louder each time.
So like what did it sound like, experienced in life, to your best ability, that would have created or possibly created the sound that you heard?
Probably, I really don't know, other than like chopping wood.
Okay.
It was very constant beats too.
Okay.
So that's what made me think it sounded like that.
What about that sound makes you think chopping wood?
It was more of how steady it was.
Okay.
Because when you chop wood, you know, you got to lift it up, you got to hold it, and then you got to put all your weight into it and all your muscle.
Yep.
And when you do it, you go.
And you kind of got a rhythm.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it had like 4 or 5, 6 of those beats.
Just chills. Like, I did not sleep well the night that I first listened to that interview about the chopping sounds. And I can't help but feel a little bit irked that the neighbors didn't call the police. Like, in a way, they've kind of normalized the behavior. Like, oh, they're just fighting again. But they also knew that things often got physical between them. So I think that they should have called. But, I mean, what's done is done, I guess. And at least they came forward with their story. And to be fair, by the time the chopping sounds started, it was probably already too late to connect him to Lisa's murder.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
When the investigators looked a little deeper into his movements, some of his communications, and maybe his possible motives, they wound up building a case that aligned him with the crime scene.
Yeah. Don't have a name.
That's okay. I've got a name.
What'd I have?
What's that?
What'd I have?
You have cannabis on you.
Oh,
that's legal.
Okay, exactly. Right.
But the police in Alton knew who he was, even though he refused to give his name to them. And his arrest allowed the police to sort of connect him to Lisa's murder. When the investigators looked a little deeper into his movements, some of his communications, and maybe his possible motives, they wound up building a case that aligned him with the crime scene physically. So he was formally indicted in June of 2022 with multiple charges. There was two counts of first-degree murder, for both for Lisa's murder and for her unborn child, intentional homicide of an unborn child, dismemberment of a human body, and concealment of a homicidal death. And then there were some other charges related to some motor vehicle offenses, blah, blah, blah. He remained extremely uncooperative. He was still refusing to give his name or say anything of any value to them. But the evidence against him was pretty tight. So from the onset, the prosecutor's office characterized the case as unusually brutal. It was the kind of violence that not only kills the person, but obliterates them. That's what they consider it when you behead someone. So not long after his indictment, there were some questions raised about his mental state and whether he was fit to stand trial. And in February of 2023, he was found unfit. So he was sent to a state facility for some mental health treatment. Now, this evaluation process kind of spanned several months, as they had to have a court-appointed psychologist kind of look at his mental state and his, if he could understand the legal proceedings and his ability to assist in his defense and some other stuff that they look at. Now, one of the issues for him was that he was a heavy drug user and his mental health concerns were really more due to his involvement in use of drugs and not so much like a cognitive decline from like a mental health disorder. So by May of 2023, after he had this treatment, which was probably detox, the court said that he had regained capacity and that he was now fit to stand trial. And so that decision was able to sort of get the chain rolling again with the courts. Now, these delays that are caused by these competency hearings are pretty common in cases that involve especially violent crime, especially where mental health has been in question. But in a case as like sensational and horrible as this one was, like every delay was just more anguish for the family, the waiting, the kind of the uncertainty of how this is going to play out. And of course, the public attention that's on them. But rather than go through this protracted, highly public trial, DeAndre entered a guilty plea in December of 2024 to several of the major charges, to the first degree murder, the intentional homicide of an unborn child, and the concealment of the human remains. So his plea spared the family from like the trauma of being cross-examined, these lengthy trials, and recounting this violence, and of course the pictures that come with it that are all just extra traumatizing. So on January 17th in 2025, Judge Neil Schroeder sentenced him to 60 years in prison. And the sentence was divided up a little bit. There was 30 years for the murder of Lisa, and then another 20 years for the death of her unborn child. And then there was about another 10 years for the additional sentences for concealment and other related charges that were kind of part of this package. Some of them were running consecutively. Now, the prosecution said that there was this law that required him to serve 100% of the murder sentence, at least 85% of the homicide of the unborn child sentence, and then there was also some certain minimums for concealment. So in the end, it's 52 years before he's eligible for parole. I mean, the 60 years is not going to bring back the two lives that were lost. But it is essentially a life sentence and one that will sort of ensure that he remains behind bars for at least the foreseeable future, if not his entire life. The state's attorney, Tom Hain, had hoped for even more years, but there's this ruling from the Illinois Supreme Court that an unborn child cannot always be treated as like a separate victim for the purposes of life sentences. So that decision kind of constrained what they could seek as far as sentencing. One of the most powerful moments in that hearing came when Lisa's mother, Heidi, addressed DeAndre directly from the court, saying in part, quote, "On that night, I received a life sentence. to live the remainder of my life without my beautiful, loving, sassy daughter, a life without knowing the joy of watching Lisa raise my granddaughter, end quote. Now, she also went on to say, though, quote, I do not hate you. I am sad and disappointed in you, end quote. So her words were not just about her own grief, but she had this moral courage to, well, to call out the violence that he had done and demand accountability for him, but also to show that she had a loving heart, just as her daughter would have. Now, she also used that moment in court to sort of caution some other people that victims of domestic violence need to speak up. We need to believe the threats that people make and to take steps for safety. Quote, this is a tragic outcome of a 2-year on and off again domestic violence relationship. This didn't have to end this way. My daughter should be here raising her daughter, end quote. Having that sentence didn't, obviously, it didn't erase the trauma for the, or the loss for the family, or even the questions they had. But for some in Lisa's family, this guilty plea in the sentencing was at least, it was at least acknowledgement and of what had happened, some accountability for him, and just, I guess, a sense, if even partially, of closure. In the months after her death and during this whole legal process, Lisa's mother and some of her extended family and friends resolved to remember her as more than just a victim of a horrible crime, and to really remember her more for her personality, her dreams, like the warmth that she had, and the motherhood that she never got to realize. So there is a GoFundMe that has been established to support her funeral and some of the legal expenses that were happening that came in from the community. Her story just really resonated with a lot of people. There have been public tributes, candlelight vigils, and there's some memorials that have been put up in Alton. Friends continue to speak of her daily kindness and her just her laughter and her capacity for love. And although this case was really sensationalized in the media, those that knew her always just knew her as a person, not as a headline, and they want to remember her as such. I think Lisa's story is a warning about domestic violence, especially in relationships that are unstable. You know, her mother has talked to some about some of the warning signs, the threats, the emotional turmoil they were going through, and these cycles of reconciliation and then of not being together again and her trying to leave. But one of the complexities in this case was the legal question of whether or not an unborn child can be treated as a separate victim for the purposes of sentencing. Now, the Illinois Supreme Court had already ruled that in some contexts, they cannot be counted as a separate victim on their own to sort of elevate a sentence to make that a life sentence. So that limitation really shaped what the prosecutors were able to seek in this case. So the sentencing had to be really thought about very carefully, like how to balance justice of the murder of Lisa and the loss of her unborn child while still trying to stay in these statutory constraints, but to get as much of a life sentence as they possibly could. Now, it also spotlighted some of the challenges of mental health defenses when it comes to violent crime, like his initial incapacity to stand trial and then being better again. And then, like, there's just this whole interplay between what's culpable and then your mental state is, it's sort of a thorny question about how the justice system can really treat individuals that have some serious psychiatric issues. And, you know, the prosecutors acknowledged that those issues were there, but like mental health cannot be a free pass to avoid any kind of accountability. And that's their stand on it. That's also my stand on it. Now, this is something that DeAndre's family has talked about publicly, like their sorrow and for the loss of Lisa's family, but also their own loss, and that they had been trying to get DeAndre help, but they feel that the mental health care services are broken. They're just not readily accessible to people, to the average person, to which is something that I strongly agree about. But I also feel like this was the issue was drugs, and it doesn't sound like DeAndre was particularly wanting any help in that area. But I do certainly feel for his family as well, just to have that stigma on them of having their son as being a murderer. So from a outsider's observer, the cautionary tale here is about when we're witnessing domestic violence in other people, some of those warning signs being that kind of on again, off again nature of a relationship, if there's some emotional strain going on, and we really underestimate threats being made, especially when those threats are being made to somebody who's pregnant, because pregnancy is actually, like, murder is the number one cause of death in pregnant women. So we need to take that stuff a little bit seriously. Like, pregnancy can actually increase the dynamics of abuse in a relationship. So if you find yourself in a similar situation, you need to act to seek some help and really trust your instincts that there's some danger there. Now, one of the big issues that I see in this story is the lack of actual actions from others. Like, I get that you can't get a person to leave an abusive situation on their own, but I think neighbors need to call the police each and every time that they hear an argument. I don't think it doesn't take more than a minute to do. Like, you're going to have to sit and listen to it anyways. You might as well try and get some intervention in there. And, like, who knows, maybe one of the times that you call, you're either going to save that person's life or they might finally decide that enough is enough and they might finally leave. So I think just call the police when you hear disturbing fighting. I think we have to stop normalizing it and saying, oh, they're just fighting again. Because the child that she was carrying, like her daughter, she never got a birthday. She never got even a name. She's just known as the unborn child. She never received the life that she really was meant to live, which is doubly cruel of a loss for a family. Like, every holiday, every milestone, just nothing but really two empty chairs at a table. But her family is really trying to remember, like, her kindness and just the glint in her eyes that she had and all the things that make her who she was. So there are some other questions that have been unanswered by this case, like what it precisely was that Durandre had sent him into such a rage to do that night. I mean, other than we think jealousy, control, maybe some kind of betrayal, like maybe he figured he wasn't the father of the baby and that set him off. We also question a little bit why she stayed or returned to that relationship. It sounds like it was extremely toxic and very violent. But I think she was a hopeful person, that she was hoping things would change. There was probably a bond there that they had, these trauma bonds. And she seems like so many victims of violence, just very forgiving person. So could some early intervention have prevented her death? I think the warning signs were there. She had been communicating some fear and there was these reconciliation and separations and all that stuff going on. Her mother was certainly in fear for her, but there aren't a lot of preventative measures like the hotlines that we have and the shelters and those protective orders. They're only as strong as those who make the call on them and who have access to them. So one of the challenges for me in trying to do a true crime narrative here is to avoid turning Lisa into like a spectacle. And in telling her story, like, I have to remain my emphasis on her life and her dreams and her other relationships that she had, rather than sensationalizing the violence that happened here. Lisa's mom, Heidi, continues to speak in some interviews at public memorials, urging others to take the threats of violence very seriously and to believe the survivors so that they can break free when they can and prevent these kinds of tragedies. I mean, it's a huge weight for her to bear, having her daughter having had this outcome. So unfortunately, Lisa has become like a reminder, a necessary reminder of what exactly is at stake when intimate violence goes unchecked. And that was the murder of Lisa Dodd. And a terrible, awful case it is. I know that there's a lot of graphicness and stuff in this story, but I don't think that that should be the emphasis of the story. I think that these kinds of cases continue to happen all over the place. It shouldn't take basically a decapitation and for an order for these stories to get the news coverage that they do. I think that regardless of how the person dies or what's done to their body afterwards, those stories are still important. They're all cautionary tales. And the important part is to not normalize it. When we hear something or see something, that we say something and we speak up about it, and that coercive control is just as dangerous as physical harm. It can all end in these kinds of violent situations. So I think a lot of the focus of some of the care that goes into preventative services for domestic violence needs to be on really trying to break those trauma bonds and focus on getting the victims to understand the danger that they're in and to try and break free on their own, because too many times women and men as well continue to go back out of their own feelings of that, whether they feel like they can fix it, whether they're hopeful about it, or whether they're just afraid. And we need to figure that part out. I think that's just as important as the shelters and all the other services that we're providing for victims of domestic violence. Anyways, I'm going to be back again next week with another terrible, awful case. In the meantime, you know what to do. And as always, thank you so much for listening and for watching.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.